Good afternoon. We are on the record. It's 5 minutes past one. In attendance are Representative Lynn, Representative Rammers, Representative Dahlstrom, Representative Gatto. I'm sure that Representative Holmes is on her way. Here she is.
Yes.
And we're anticipating Representative Gruenberg, and Representative Herron is excused from the committee. He is traveling in district and called me from Alakanuk earlier today. We have two issues that we're going to take up today that are of note. The first one is, thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Gruenberg is in House Transportation Committee, which is regularly, is a standing committee, scheduled regularly on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 1 till 3. And we are going to anticipate more Thursday meetings, and we will work around Representative Gruenberg's schedule. Today we're going to take up two issues. The second one involves underage driver's licenses and serving convicted felons alcohol. We're going to do that with our friend Representative Crawford at approximately 2 o'clock this afternoon. From now until then, we are going to take up the issue of the overview of the security breach of personal information of Alaska State employees and state retirees. And this issue came to light when the Attorney General called me, and then and other members of the legislature, and then made some public remarks. And we're very interested in pursuing this issue, finding out what happened, what the remedy is for those Alaskans who feel exposure, and what we're going to do in the future to prevent this from happening again. Jane, do we want to start with our friend Ed Sniffen and have him take us through this, or with Kevin Brooks is here also?
Well, we have retirement benefits, admin, and you can bring them all up if you want, however you wish.
I think we'll start at the scene of the crime. and have Kevin Brooks come up here, and he signaled that he wants his counsel with him, Ed Sniffen. So we will invite both of you gentlemen up, and if I can say before you introduce yourself, men, for the public, because we're benefited by having gavel to gavel in the room today, and so for the benefit of the public, Kevin Brooks, I've known since I came to the legislature in this is my beginning of my sixth year, and I know that Representative Lynn and Gatto and Dahlstrom have had the pleasure of serving with him longer, and this is your third year serving with Mr. Brooks at the as the Deputy Commissioner of Administration, and you have been terrific, and your integrity is above reproach, and you are a dedicated public servant, and so I thank you for your work, and I want to make sure that we're all on the record recognizing that you're here to be a problem solver and that you're not the messenger. As for Mr. Sniffen, a whole nother story. No, I joke. We our committee has had the privilege of working with Mr. Sniffen on the retail gasoline and in exploring that on behalf of all Alaskans, and there is no more of a Boy Scout or a tireless advocate in looking out for consumer protections for the citizens of Alaska, in my own estimation, and I'm quite certain that that point of view is shared around this table. And Mr. Sniffen, you are an A-plus terrific guy. You are the people's advocate, and you are tireless in that pursuit, and so I thank you also. And I think that what we want to do today is really disseminate information to.
Do you have any recording problems? Can we take a short
Yes, we'll take a brief at ease. Record our compliments to Mr. Sniffen seems to have taken down our whole audio system, and in any rate, we're delighted to have you two gentlemen before us to kind of take us through the narrative of what transpired, what remedies are available to Alaskans, and what we're going to do to prevent this from happening again. So that said, as good public servants, the floor is yours. If you introduce yourself and then just take us through your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Ramirez, and thank you for those incredibly kind remarks. With me today in the audience, we also have Craig Tillery from the Department of Law, who was instrumental in working out some of the terms of the settlement that we reached with Price Waterhouse in this unfortunate breach. What I'd like to start with is is a timeline of what happened and the response that was made to the notice we received about this breach. And then I'm going to talk briefly about the settlement and what it provides. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about what we're doing going forward to implement the settlement. So bear with me. I'll try to be brief, and then we'll let Kevin discuss some of the issues involving what the state is doing now to ensure these kinds of things don't happen again. I want to start with when this information went missing, and that was in early December when Price Waterhouse realized that they had information from Mercer as part of some litigation that contained personal information, and that they couldn't locate it. We were notified about this on Tuesday, January 19th, and then Wednesday, the 20th, the Attorney General was on the phone to Price Waterhouse with some strong conversation expressing his displeasure about the loss of this information. On that same Friday, the 22nd of January, we actually got copies of the information that went missing so we could analyze it and figure out what it was and who was on the list. And over the weekend and continuing through Monday, January 25th, that analysis continued, and at the same time we were feverishly working on a settlement agreement with PricewaterhouseCoopers to address the breach and how to protect Alaskans. And then on Wednesday, the 27th, just over a week from hearing about this, we had inked a deal. We'd signed the settlement agreement with PricewaterhouseCoopers, and then the very next day, Thursday, the 28th, is when the Attorney General held a press conference to announce the settlement and its terms. So everything happened fairly quickly from the state's perspective, from the time we received notice until the time notice was made to consumers that this had happened. Since that time, we've been engaged in daily conference calls with a team of lawyers from Pricewaterhouse and the service provider who will be implementing credit monitoring for people who elect to do that, Equifax, to get actual hard copy notices to each of the affected individuals by mail. And currently, those notices are scheduled to be dropped in the mail tomorrow.
Good.
Let me talk just briefly now about what the settlement requires. Pricewaterhouse certainly accepted responsibility for this loss, and we made that very clear when we were working with them that that was something that they needed to do, and they have done that. To protect Alaskans, what they have agreed to do is provide at least 2 years of credit monitoring service or to pay for a security freeze on each affected individual's credit file. The services may be extended for some period of time if during the two-year monitoring period we become aware of information that suggests there have been identity theft problems or if there are a number of claims. And Pricewaterhouse has agreed to indemnify consumers for any losses they may have incurred as a result of becoming a victim of identity theft, you know, during this monitoring period. And those are all, you know, fairly important and strong protections for consumers that we are fairly certain don't find themselves in other settlements other states have reached because of breaches like this. Pricewaterhouse also agreed to pay for our costs of sending these notices out, so the state would not have to do that, up to $100,000, and we think our costs are going to come in something less than that. They've also agreed to indemnify the state of Alaska for any claims we are subject to as a result of this breach. And one thing of note, too, and I think we've received some consumer calls about this, a settlement does not release any claims that consumers may have against Pricewaterhouse. Our settlement only releases the claims the state has. So if consumers are still aggrieved and they wish to take action, they're free to take whatever action they'd like. We did not release any claims on behalf of individual consumers. So all in all, we think this settlement is a very strong one. It is aimed at maximum protection for consumers against becoming victims of identity theft. One of the really important features of the settlement, though, is this presumption that if you do become a victim of identity theft, that your circumstance was the result of this breach and not some other loss of information. And that's important because in most cases, if you want to allege somebody's responsible for your damages as an identity theft victim, you have to establish a causal connection between your harm and the loss of this information and not the loss of some other information or that it was obtained somewhere else. So the settlement provides a presumption to consumers who take advantage of the terms of the settlement. They sign up for credit monitoring or get a security freeze. The presumption will be that whatever identity theft loss you incur was a result of this breach, and that is strong protection for consumers and very important. So it is a we think it's a very good, well negotiated settlement. Going forward, since the press conference, as I mentioned, we've been in daily communication with PricewaterhouseCoopers and Equifax. Notices were drafted as quickly as possible. It was quite a piece of work to coordinate information, the notices, with the vendor who was going to be providing credit monitoring services. We had to have unique identifiers generated for each individual consumer to be placed on a letter that they could use to sign up for the free service. We had to get call centers in place. There was a lot of work that went into setting up a process to deal with consumer concerns once these notices go out, and we are in a position now to send those notices out tomorrow, and people will be able to start signing up for these protections beginning early next week. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions the committee might have, and I'm sure, Kevin, if you would like to address protections going forward.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've not gone back and done any investigation on this question, but I'm thinking you might know. A year or two ago, we passed some new identity theft provisions in this state that require, when things like this happen, require that people be notified. Was the state in compliance with those rules, and was PricewaterhouseCoopers in compliance? I mean, it sounds like the state actually moved a lot faster, but especially that problem surfacing in early December and the state not even being notified for a month and a half. Did that break any of our identity theft laws?
Representative Holmes, through the chair, that excellent question. We've had that come up. The legislation you refer to, HB 65, codified now at Title 45.48, requires that an information collector provide notice of a security breach as soon as practicable and without unreasonable delay. Information collector is defined very interestingly in the bill, and if you read through it, it's a little complicated. The owner of this information is certainly the state of Alaska. We provided this information, through the decades to our actuary Mercers for, their work in advising the Department of Administration on retirement benefit issues. But we collected the information from consumers, provided it to Mercer. Mercer, in turn, gave it to Pricewaterhouse as part of this litigation. So we were certainly an information collector. Pricewaterhouse may be an information collector, but it's a little fuzzier. If you read the definitions, it's more likely that they're an information recipient. They may also be an information collector. If they were, they would have been required to provide notice as soon as, practicable, but without unreasonable delay. Whether they complied with that by waiting until January to notify us when they knew this information was missing in December, doubtful. Have they complied since then? We think as long as they comply with the terms of the settlement agreement that they are currently in compliance, and we have, reached this agreement with them to take care of consumers. The state of Alaska certainly has been in compliance with that legislation, and I think, the timeline that I outlined, I think, demonstrates an incredible effort on behalf of a lot of people to get these things done as quickly as possible, and I can't imagine a scenario where it could have happened any faster. So, yes, the state is in compliance, will continue to be in compliance. Is Pricewaterhouse in compliance now? Yes. Were they? Doubtful. We would need more information about, when they discovered the breach, what efforts they took to investigate it. Were they trying to determine if it really was lost or missing? So there's some leeway in the statute that allows for that kind of conduct to occur before you have to send out a bunch of notices. In this case, I'd be curious to follow up on that a little more to find out if they were or not. But currently they are in compliance, and we're happy they've done this deal with us.
Thank you.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have several questions that I've compiled here from a few different people. Can I just put them all on the table? Maybe make a few notes, because I think you can answer them all, jointly. These are the questions. why did the state provide Mercer with full name, social security, and date of birth when the actuarial analysis would only need sex, age, years of service, and tier number? If the personnel must, I provide a survivor's benefit for my wife, was her personnel information also lost? If the personnel do have to provide their own security, how do they get reimbursement for the cost? Parentheses, maybe forever. The security breach fact states, quote, the settlement we breached with PricewaterhouseCooper contains provisions that will likely, and likely is underlined, reimburse you for damages you sustain. What is meant by likely? What about the time and inconvenience experienced by personnel because of the state's mistake? What if PricewaterhouseCooper discovers that the cost is so great that they file bankruptcy? Is this the only information that was lost? Example, if you have a direct deposit, was the bank account number lost? And with only the name, social security number, and age, a person's bank account and other personal accounts can be breached. How are we to protect ourselves from this? Thank you.
Vice Chairman Dahlstrom, through the chair, we have these questions, I think, in an email form, and we will try to answer all of these for you in order. I think I'm going to let Kevin answer the first one, because he may know why the names of Social Security numbers were provided to Mercer. And my take on that, after talking with these folks, is it was required for them to perform the actuarial analysis they had to perform. But beyond that, I don't know the details of why they needed it. I just know that it was required.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Kevin Brooks. I am the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Administration, and as Mr. I'll echo Mr. Sniffen's comments. We appreciate your kind words about us, and hope that our bosses heard it before the recording went off. With all seriousness, though, this information, I think the timeline that Mr. Sniffen laid out is important. I mean, this is information we were given the Mercer in the probably the 2003-2004 time frame. Mercer shared it with, it became an issue during this subsequent lawsuit on a different matter. And when Mercer got it, they did some manipulation of that data for modeling and so forth for work that they were doing for us. And so it was important for the state to get it back in the form, in that manipulated format that they had. And so that's kind of the chain. And so we got it back and went to Price Waterhouse for analysis in this, as part of the lawsuit. But I think what we found out as we testified on HB 65 a couple years ago, and Mr. Sniffen and I probably sat in the same chairs and talked about that at the time, Social Security numbers have really evolved. And 10 years ago, we really weren't even talking about identity theft. It just really wasn't on our radar, so to speak. Very recently, we had Social Security numbers right on your driver's license. And so it's really something that's evolved. If someone asks us for that today, we're absolutely saying, why do you need it, and what for what reason? The fact that it was given to them six or seven years ago, it really was in response to work that they're doing for us as our actuary, and enabled them to uniquely identify individuals in that pool with the demographics that were associated with them and trying to determine actuarial costs for retirement and other reasons. Another factor that's played into this is in the past, before another piece of legislation that passed the legislature, SB 125, was a cost share bill where we made pension reform. It pooled all of the liabilities for all public employers, but prior to that, every individual had a unique unfunded liability associated with them. And so, the atmosphere that we operate in as relates to pension and actuarial analysis has really evolved in the last 10 years. At the time, it was necessary. And again, as I say, if they asked us today, they'd have to have a pretty darn good reason to have that combination of information, or it wouldn't be provided.
On to the next question, a survivor's benefit for this gentleman's wife, was her personal information also lost? The way to find out for sure is to call the Division of Retirement Benefits. There's an 800 number that was provided in the press release. It's also on their website. And the entire database of individuals whose information was lost is accessible, and someone can call and just give them a name, and they'll tell you if that's the case. So not sure if this, in this particular case, a survivor's benefit would have necessarily been included or not.
Well, and as a follow-up, we got to look at the list of questions before the meeting and check on that. And for a survivor, it was age only. So it would have been just... That would have been the only information provided. But absolutely, the ultimate check would be to call and say, am I on the list? And that's.
Representative Cotto.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I think it's probably safe to assume that Mercer has this data, the state of Alaska has this data, and that the data is not lost. We just don't know if an unknown person has a copy of the data. So... Since we have the original data, is there a way to nullify the existing data, add a separate code, and retain the data you have to essentially make the old data require a password that whoever has it would not be able to know?
You have 15 seconds.
Yes.
Can I get a license? Call an expert.
Representative Gatto, through the chair, the data that was lost was, you know, Social Security numbers and dates of birth and names. if that information is and you can see Mercer has it, our experts still retain some of it, we have it. There's not much you can do to that, I think, to make that not useful to the people who already have it. I think they're going to have it. The best thing we could do is just get it back or get some assurances that it's been destroyed as soon as they no longer need it, you know, for state purposes. And I think that's certainly the intent of the state, to make sure that only people who need it, you know, have it. I can't think of a way in 15 seconds here how we could do something to make that data not useful to people who already have it.
Well, if I may, Mr. What I was thinking was, if you make a new database where a Social Security number is unneeded, what you're saying is that a person who has this database is simply going to go shop around. They don't care about your retirement. They just care about your name, address, and Social Security number. So that even if we modified our database, an unknown person could still have that little core piece of information that could destroy 77,000 people's credit.
Representative Gatto, through the chair, that's correct. The big fear here is that somebody with the information they have, if in fact they have it, and we're not certain that's the case, but they would use that information to open up new accounts in your name and then use those accounts to get cash, to buy goods and services, and you would not know about it until creditors came collecting. And nothing you could do, I think, prospectively to try and change that would impact that potential activity. It would could pretend we could, I suppose, at well, I'll let Kevin speak to that at Department of Administration, you know, change the way they use their account, so people will have to have some other kind of identifier to access retirement and benefit account information, but it still wouldn't stop, you know, new account fraud if somebody had it.
And in effect, through the chair and Representative Gatto, that's exactly what we've done. Kind of gets into some of the other questions that were raised, but we now have a retiree, it's a unique retiree identification number in lieu of a Social Security number, and it's the same thing for active employees. We have an employee identification number that has replaced a Social Security number as an identifier. So, you know, we're taking those kinds of measures now prospectively.
So, gentlemen, just one moment, Representative Holmes. So here's the root of it for me, the two questions that I have. One is, I Googled how many people lost their had identity theft last year. And it's a remarkably large number. One statistic here says that the number of U.S. adult victims of identity fraud decreased from 10.1 million in 2003 to 9.3 million in 2005 to 8.9 million in 2006. And we know from all the attention that the U.S. Census Bureau is initiating, we have about 300 million Americans, so that's presume that to be about 3% a year. So that would presume that of these 77,000 Alaskans who feel exposed right now, 3% of them per year for the time being are likely to have their identity challenged, whether it's due to this mishandling of information between Pricewaterhouse and the state's records, or if it's just bad luck by being an American in the wrong place at the wrong time. And so I need to be walked through, again, the steps that Alaskans can take now and what an Alaskan would want to do, what steps that they would want to take, because we can rest assured that that's 77,000 Alaskans, 3% would be 2,000 a year, you know, are going to come right back to the state of Alaska and say, hey, you've shared this liability with me, or Price Waterhouse does, and Price Waterhouse is not going to be fast to satisfy the needs of Alaskans with these kind of statistics floating out there, which is a concern to me. And then secondly, before we're too dismissive about the way that we're handling this, and again, I don't question the professionalism or the response time from General Sullivan. Nobody is more on the spot than General Sullivan, for sure. But as a member of this committee and a broader legislature that sat through the PERS-TERS battles of 05 and 06, there were so many 70 and 80-year-old retirees that we were contacted by that were just petrified that they were going to lose existing benefits that weren't all affected by Tier 1 retirees, but they were receiving so much misinformation and so much fear-mongering was out there about what could happen to them, that we changed the quality of life for a lot of Alaskans. And so what I'd like to hear from you is, A, what are we going to do about the people that have identity theft and that may just be a normal course of doing business in the United States? And secondly, what are we going to do to soothe the fears? Like this letter that Representative Dahlstrom wrote from this 63-year-old man.
You're young.
Representative Lynn, I was going to say, you are a very hip representative. But we have a certain obligation to some of our retirees that really, to my way of thinking, goes beyond having Price Waterhouse pay for the postage to send a letter to them to say, hey, here's a one-time letter, everything's fine. And here's the steps you have to take if something goes wrong, and voila, we've created a government program. And I am going to challenge you to try harder to soothe those Alaskans that feel like they are more greatly at risk now than they were before this incident happened. They were just pursuing the quiet enjoyment of their lives. And so I just kind of want you to noodle around on that for the next 15 minutes, and then before we move on to Representative Crawford's piece of legislation, I'd like for you to tell me what we're going to do to try harder a little bit to satisfy not hip legislators, very secure people like Representative Lynn, but some of our Alaskans who have, dedicated a lifetime of service and now are away, and a letter is not quite the degree of security that they were hopeful of receiving. So with that, I'll let you stew on those two questions for a little bit and come back to them. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this question is probably more for Mr. Brooks and follows up on something you said earlier when you talked about how 6, 7, 10 years ago it wasn't a big deal to give out Social Security numbers. I had them on my driver's license. We all did. And now we look at that kind of information differently. Can you give me any specifics on either in response to this recent crisis or just independently, how the state, has it changed its procedures in any way? Do we have any new policies in place for when we give out this information and when we don't? And if not, are we in the process of working on those?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, thank you for the question. We have, and actually it wasn't as a result of this breach so much as it was the passage of HB 65. Which we testified on a regular basis and thought about, how would this affect the state? And really, the bill requires disclosure, that the breach has occurred, and that's happened. And I think, as Mr. Stephens articulated, there's been steps beyond disclosure to try and soothe people's concerns, getting at that piece of it. But we have, since that time, we've looked at everything from again, as I mentioned, changing these retiree identification numbers and employee identification numbers and replacing Social Security wherever it can, in on the for state employees, for instance, we don't use Social Security number on timesheets, we don't use it on leave slips. Those were all common practices for decades. We're looking much more closely at physical security. If you walked down to the sixth floor of the state office building today, you'd have to wear a lanyard with a ID card to be able to walk back where you might have a chance of seeing personal information on somebody's computer screen or on papers on their desk. So it is running the gamut of physical security. We're in the electronic realm, we're encrypting. We have software that we've, through appropriations we've received from the legislature, we have software that recognizes a string of numbers that looks like it could be a Social Security number and will automatically encrypt that. But I don't think we'll ever get to a point where we've arrived and said, okay, everything's fine, because it's going to be an ongoing recognition that, you know, there's bad people in the world who have pretty ingenious ways of getting at personal information. And I know in talking to our security folks in the IT realm, they say on a daily basis we have attempts
expiration date
at, you know, breaching the state's networks, for instance. And so, you know, we have to be vigilant on it. We have to update our signatures so that by signatures I mean the software recognition, so it's updated with new and improved attacks on it. But I think it's something in this day and age that we'll continue to try and refine and ensure security as best we can.
If I could add to that, Representative Holmes, through the chair, I want to dispel any notion in at least this Price Waterhouse incident that the state of Alaska was at fault in any way. And I know a lot of consumers are angry at the state, and I think unjustifiably so, because we did nothing wrong here. You know, this was a breach that occurred from, you know, a vendor that the state was, well, actually a subcontractor of a vendor that the state was using. So it wasn't the result of any failure in state security measures that this happened. And I think what Mr. Brooks had mentioned are just things that, as a result of HB 65 and new measures that the state is taking going forward to make sure that we don't have this kind of breach in the future. And I'd like to respond to Chairman Ramirez's comments about, you know, what can consumers do now and how can they feel better going forward with their identity and becoming victims of identity theft, because those are very good questions and they are difficult answers. Fortunately, because of this particular settlement, Alaskans are in a much better position than other Americans, because if you are the victim of identity theft while in the next 2 years, if you've taken advantage of the provisions we provided, it's going to be presumed that your loss was caused by this particular breach. It's a rebuttable presumption, but you can go to Price Waterhouse and say, I've been a victim, I was signed up for credit monitoring, or I had a security freeze in place, pay my losses. And they're going to do it. As you mentioned, Chairman Ramirez, 3% of these people might have had identity theft anyway. But now, because of this particular loss, they have some protection that they wouldn't have otherwise had. And this presumption is something that is critical in that respect. Going forward, I think the things that Mr. Brooks just mentioned, you know, trying to protect the information that the state has and trying to keep that under wraps is something we can do to help prevent this stuff from getting out there. But the reality of it is this information has been out in the universe for decades, and who knows how people get a hold of it. And people are going to become the victims of identity theft no matter what we do. And in order to protect yourselves, you have to do some of the things that we're recommending people do in this particular settlement. And when people get the notice, they will know that. And that is, you know, monitor your accounts regularly. You know, check your credit reports. If you sign up for credit monitoring, you'll be able to do that whenever you want. You'll have access to your credit reports all the time. Look for, you know, new account fraud. It does place a little bit of a burden on consumers that they might not have had before. But they may have been at risk regardless of this breach. And this maybe makes them a little worried that they're more at risk, but these steps, they're not that onerous. They're free, and consumers can take advantage of them and help protect themselves. And I think just in the, you know, the world we live in, this identity theft issue isn't going to go away anytime soon, and it's just always good, you know, financial responsibility to do those kinds of things. So I don't know if that that makes you feel any better, because I know people are still going to become victims of identity theft. We've got Price Waterhouse to look to in the next few years anyway to help recover those losses for some consumers.
Mr. Chairman, if you don't mind, if I could just add on. I mean, I would hazard a guess if you asked people in this room, you might come up with the 3%. Last October, my own credit card had some bogus charges showing up on it, and I had to go through that process myself of, you know, canceling the card and challenging some charges that showed up there. And so, yeah, I think it is a fact of life that we're going to have to all, you know, live with. And I don't mean to say that in an offhanded kind of way, but it's just that personal responsibility for being diligent, balanced with taking the responsibility that we, you know, we had a role in this. And, you know, I won't disagree strongly with Ed, but the state did not, you know, lose this. We had, it was a subcontractor who had a legitimate business reason for having the information, and it went missing. But we are, you know, we're stepping up and trying to be as responsible as we can, and also recognizing that it's a disruption to people, that they have to take some measures, and we certainly understand that.
Thank you, Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. From the public's point of view, you hired a chauffeur to drive our car, and the guy turned out to be a DUI. And so you're not off the hook, because it was your distinct decision. Now, I'm not in that camp, but when you said the state of Alaska, people think it's our fault. Well, of course. You made that decision that sent their money into limbo, or they think. So that's why they feel that way. I had a second one, but I'll pick it up later.
No, Representative Gatto, through the chair, I appreciate those comments. I understand that is a perception, and it may be a warranted one, you know, as well. But the actual loss, you know, didn't come from you know, a security measure that we haven't implemented, and that was my point. But I appreciate the clarification. If we could continue with Representative Dahlstrom's questions, we've got a few I think answers that we can give. One of them is the only information that was lost name and Social Security number, or was it account numbers? And no, the only information was name, Social Security numbers, and date of birth. So no other account information was given up. And then with that information, this constituent was asking, you know, can these people infiltrate your bank accounts and get other information from you? And the answer is, yeah, they can, and they might try. The most common use of this kind of information by identity thieves is to open up new accounts. But if they do try to infiltrate your existing accounts, that's why we encourage people to continue monitoring all of their existing accounts. You get those statements every month. They're easy to check. If you see any suspicious activity, you know, act on it. It's the new accounts that you don't get statements for that are really the problem, and that's something that credit monitoring will help you identify. Were there any other questions on that list that we missed? I think there was one question that I got from I think the same gentleman, and that is, why do I have to do anything? Why isn't the state just take care of this for me? Why do I have to sign up for credit monitoring? You know, I shouldn't have to lift a finger to take advantage of these things. And that's a good question, and I sympathize with consumers who have that sentiment. The problem with that, though, is in order to take advantage of the credit monitoring services that will be provided, you're going to need to set up an account that provides a way for them to notify you if there are problems with your credit file. You're going to have to give them an email address. You're going to have to maybe give them another address if you want notice by mail. You need to get a unique identifier in order to sign up for the services, and you're going to have to identify yourselves to the credit bureau in order to sign up. So there's a lot of personal interaction that goes into setting up these credit monitoring accounts for each individual consumer that the state just can't do for you. It is going to take you know, a phone call. We've tried to make it as painless as possible for everybody to call, give them a code. You're going to sign up. It's going to take less than a couple minutes, and you'll be done. So we apologize that that's something we couldn't do, you know, for everybody, but we hope it won't be that onerous.
Representative Gatto.
Thank you. Occasionally you go to a merchant or a doctor and fill out this form, and it says Social Security number. Can any person demand it as a requirement for conducting business? Department of Law.
Representative Gatto, through the chair. That's a complicated answer. In some circumstances, Yes, and in some circumstances, no. You know, you certainly couldn't be turned away from an emergency room if you don't have a social security number for treatment. Could a healthcare provider say, well, I need this information so we can file Medicare or Medicaid claims on your behalf if you're a Medicaid patient? Then they can require that. The state is prohibited by statute from refusing to provide services to individuals who do not give a Social Security number, and that's part of a Privacy Act. So the state cannot refuse services in some circumstances. Private business probably can, but then you can choose not to do business with those people who demand your Social Security number. So there are a range of different entities providing different kinds of services, and some are probably entitled to get the information to provide the service, and some entities like state government, we cannot refuse service if someone does not provide it. Is that a good wishy-washy lawyer answer?
Yes, it is. Very wishy-washy, because when you walk into a doctor's office, they sign here, new patient, and Social Security number, and you put leave it blank, and it comes right back to you saying, well, you have to provide that.
Yes.
And so you can make up nine numbers and just put it down there. Now are you guilty of fraud?
That's a good question, but I know even now Social Security numbers appear on Medicaid cards, or Medicare cards, when you want to go get service, and that's something that we have told the AARP folks and the senior centers when we give presentations on identity theft to only take that card with you when you need to go get service, but that's a number that's still required. But I just had knee surgery in December, and I know more about this area than a lot of people in the state. And I refused to give them my Social Security number, and they refused to give me any service.
Pain medication.
So I ended up, giving the information, hoping that they'll, keep it confidential. It's tricky. If I had made up a number, I don't know what would have happened, if that would have come back to haunt me later in some way or not, but I would have hesitated to give false information.
Just get the last two reversed or something.
So, gentlemen, we're kind of bumping up on the time that we had allocated for this today. Here's a question I have for you. How do recipients of pension benefits receive a pension? Do they receive? Is it because Price Waterhouse had our information? Is it through direct deposit? Are there hard copy statements that are mailed to our retirement people that are enjoying retirement benefits?
Mr. Chairman, we, as far as payment, we have a large number that get direct deposit. We have a not insignificant number that still receive a check.
Okay. Where I'm going, gentlemen, I am. Just mindful of the of all Alaskans that perhaps have a disproportionate concern to the risk that you're bracketing for us. You're suggesting that there is a modest amount of risk, but we are aware that some Alaskans have a disproportionate amount of risk relative to the risk profile that you believe that they should have, and you have laid out some steps. And so I think my interest is in, I'm very grateful to the Attorney General for being so proactive so quickly, and for you gentlemen being so forthcoming on behalf of the state of Alaska, defining our position, and that the state itself was victimized by Price Waterhouse's shoddy handling of this information. And our response now appears to have been not only to negotiate a two-year settlement for Alaskans, but also to notify them in writing. And so what I'm looking for is some mechanism for supplemental notification to make an inquiry or to let them know that we're still on the job to address the softer set of issues, this intangible component where we have disrupted their quiet enjoyment of their lives. We're not alarmed. Representative Lynn is remarkably calm, but there are others, I think. And again, we our office was inundated with hundreds of letters from retirees, Alaskan retirees, who thought they were going to lose their health benefits when we were doing Senate Bill 141, and those health benefits weren't on the table, but some Alaskans have a disproportionate concern to what's moving through state government because they're at a distance from it now. So what additional remedies are available to the state in the form of supplemental notification or supplemental inquiry that doesn't, I'm not trying to augment the state's risk, I'm just trying to, you know, meet the need that we have for those Alaskans.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just initial reaction. You know, we have letters are hitting the mail tomorrow.
Okay.
Where all these folks are going to get it. And I really would like to take some time and see what response we get to that. A couple things come to mind. We could look at public service announcements. There's any number of things after some period of time, 30 days or something down the line. But many of our retirees live out of state, and correct, reaching all of them some kind of a efficient, consistent manner is a challenge. But if you get outside of the realm of writing a letter to them.
Well, for instance, I mean, I'm just trying to think out of the box. I attended Governor Parnell's conference on the third floor that was led by our colleague, Representative Fairclough, on domestic violence, sexual assault, an issue that we've been taking up in this room on behalf of the governor's office. And the governor put out on a challenge. He said, well, what are inexpensive things that we can do to bring attention to this situation? And one of them was the domestic violence march that he's organized on March 31st. So, for instance, there are many of these organizations for the retirement community that have newsletters for different state entities or professional groups. Representative Dahlstrom and I retired from the same group, and we stay in touch, but we don't both subscribe to that newsletter. But we certainly stay in touch. I mean, have we taken steps to try to think out of the box to do a second tranche of notification for Alaskans that may feel that their security was compromised? And I would appreciate it, since our committee has looked into this, if let's say today is the 11th of February, if you could make a notation by the 11th of March, a month from now, to get back with us on some secondary steps that the Department of Administration can take through organized newsletters, or how many of these people do you reach with hard copy statements, where it's easy enough to do an insert the way that Chugach or MEA or Golden Valley might do, that where we can go out and talk about what Representative Gatto has brought to our attention, that it's certainly it's Price Waterhouse that compromised Alaskans, but there is some implied or inferred obligation that the state has, I think, to make other Alaskans feel like they're whole. And I'm seeing some consensus around the table for that. So if you could perhaps generate a letter for us by the 11th of March, what those steps are, and I'll circulate that to our members. And then at that time, when 30 days has elapsed, then maybe we'll schedule you just for a 15-minute follow-up or 30-minute follow-up on how we're doing, on what happened the first 30 days after we addressed this with these letters. We want to keep it constructive and positive, but we want to make sure that those Alaskans feel like we're watching out for them. And to that end, if you could provide us the 800 number at Retirement and Benefits, we can get it on the record, and then Jane, what does it say? See, if first number to call. And then maybe the first number to call if you think that your information has been compromised. I think that you list that. It says to request your credit report by phone. I think this is information we have, and I assume that this is information that is being circulated to the general public. So if we could just get a couple of those numbers on record, just I like to use gavel to gavel like it's an infomercial. So and if you can offer them the free Ginsu knives and the juicer and a couple of 1-800 numbers to call, I would be appreciative.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and thank you. In the meantime, we will look into the types of way that we reach out to our, whether it's retirees or actives, and look at inserts or cards that we can do, and we'll get back to you in 30 days.
Great.
There's a number at the Department of Administration, 1-800. 821-2251, and people can call there and get help. And that's the number we have. This letter that's going out to individuals tomorrow will have a specific letter with their unique identifier for them to call and get to some of the credit protections that we've talked about.
And those numbers won't be effective until Monday or Tuesday, so we're not releasing those numbers until the letter goes out tomorrow, so the folks at Equifax and BWC don't get inundated. So, but those numbers will be mailed out tomorrow. But the one now that people can call with questions is the 800 number that Kevin provided.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Mr. Chair, so if one does not get a letter in the next week, they can assume safely that they are not in that group of information that was compromised, or is there a website they can go to double-check that, put their name in?
Yes, Representative Dahlstrom, through the chair, you can always call this number to find out if you're on the list. Everyone on the list will be mailed a letter. Whether everyone on the list gets the letter, you know, we're anticipating, you know, well over, you know, 95%, you know, delivery rate, I think. But occasionally the mail messes up. It might be misdelivered. It may go somewhere else. So I'm sure there will be a small percentage of people who are on the list who don't get the letter, but we're hoping that won't be many. But again, that number is a good number to call to find out if anyone's on the list.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any other questions? Gentlemen, we thank you very much for being so accommodating and for being so transparent in your presentation and so helpful and constructive. We look forward to your letter in a month and to a brief presentation, a follow-up presentation, sometime in mid-March after we receive that letter and we're able to circulate it amongst the Judiciary Committee. We will make that letter available to all 60 of our colleagues through our mail system. So that they are mindful of the way that we're following up, and then we'll look forward just to a short follow-up presentation as to how many people have contacted. I assume that you'll be keeping track of some statistics and things and get a sense of this, and then hopefully that story will get out and it will calm folks that do feel that they've been compromised. And we thank you very much for coming before the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very much. Thank you. We'll take a brief at ease.
DJ, here's my... knock you over.
We're back on the record.
That's scary.
Yes, we are. We're back on the record. We would like to invite our colleague Terry Crawford. Very happy to have you here, Representative Crawford. Congratulations on your 43 years in the wilderness. Things are happening to you at every turn now. We're happy to have you before you. Just a piece of housekeeping before we hear from Representative Crawford. We did, at Representative Gruenberg's request, we did get the scrubbed version of House Bill 298. He's reviewed it. It's good for him. I want to make sure it's good for other members and we can release it. And any other members have any concerns with HB 298? Seeing none, you can... forward the bill on. Representative Crawford, we are so happy to have you here before us, and this is House Bill 283. I am looking forward to being taken through this bill. You and I have some shared interests in this bill when it comes to identification cards and to minors' driver's licenses, and then I'm interested in the other issues that are addressed in this bill before us. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee. I appreciate you having me here. I've sat in this witness chair numerous times over the last 10 years on numerous bills. None of them am I as personally connected to as I am this bill. So in the interest of full disclosure, at Christmas Eve of 2004, my wife was hit by a drunk driver after coming out of church on the Christmas Eve program that we had. This drunk driver hit my wife and missed my son by inches. And subsequently, when we were in the emergency room and it was touch and go for about 3 days, where we didn't know whether she was going to make it or not, numerous people asked me if they caught the guy, and what had happened to him. And I kept thinking, I'm not interested in whether they caught the guy or not. That wasn't at all my concern. What I was concerned about was what had happened to my wife and what my family was facing for the future if she wasn't there, because she was the center of our family. She's the center of our lives. And all I could think about was, if I could change this, I'd change this in a way to keep it from happening, to work on prevention, because obviously punishment is not working. There's still thousands of drunk drivers out there. It's on a daily basis. We got this, the original part of this bill passed a couple of years ago. This has been in effect. We have now, at last count, 2,133 of these marked driver's licenses and state IDs out there of people that have proven they can't handle alcohol. We weren't able to get the original bill through as a mandatory check, and what we did was instead try to establish an incentive for people to check the driver's licenses, even though you might not look anywhere near 21. Look like me. Most people don't ask me for my driver's license, although I always offer my driver's license every time I go into a restaurant or bar or whatever, order a meal and a glass of wine, and they don't ask me for my driver's license. I say, here, you need to look at this. And I have a blue license. I intend to continue to have a blue license, but I want people to check the IDs of those people that buy alcohol, because there are 2,133 of those people out there on our streets and roads that are not responsible. Not responsible operators. And we've changed this bill to make it a fine of $2,000 that would go to the business owner, and we have a letter of intent that would the intent is that they would share $1,000 of that with the clerk that actually confiscated the license. And $1,000 would go to the business owner, and to make it a real incentive to check these licenses. Brown Jug does that on the underage driver's licenses and fake driver's licenses, and they've done that over 2,000 times in the years that's been in effect. They've collected fines of approximately $2 million. That's just one liquor store out of many. I'm proud that they do that, but I'd like for others to do that as well. We've also expanded this bill to not only be just for felony DUI offenders, but for people that have committed three misdemeanors that were alcohol-related. So if you have three domestic violence misdemeanors with that were committed under the influence of alcohol, the judge could. Now, it's permissive. It's up to the judge's discretion, but the judge could put orders on their sentence as well to have a red license or a red state ID as well. So that's basically what this bill does. It ups the fine and therefore ups the reward for these businesses doing the right thing. And it also brings people that are chronically committing offenses under the influence of alcohol.
Thank you. Representative Crawford, the committee intends to move this piece of legislation. So I just want to make that clear to you. But I am looking in here for some of the provisions that we discussed. And we do have Whitney Brewster, who is available for questions, along with Quinlan Steiner, the Public Defender's Agency. And two of the areas that I want to discuss, and one I'm concerned is missing.
Right. Here. Well, I have an explanation for that. Okay.
And so the first question I have is I'd like to talk about I want to have a conversation about chronic inebriates that are in our community. We have discussed chronic inebriates at length in the Fairbanks community, and how this bill helps to address that problem by putting this red dot on not all but some folks with three misdemeanor convictions, because I think it's very constructive for that purpose, although it doesn't do anything to have their friend go buy the alcohol, which, you know, with the package stores, it remains a problem. And then secondly, you and I had talked about a red stripe on all minors' driver's licenses to augment the work that this committee and did on House Bill 75 in the last legislative session with the help of DMV, which is been a step in the right direction, the same way that you characterize the work that you had done before. And I want to see if we can take another step in that direction so that we eliminate people over the age of 21 using minors' driver's licenses, you know, to go in and out of beverage dispensary establishments and package stores. So I'll need Whitney to direct us to that, or I'm going to want to draft an amendment to incorporate that in here unless it doesn't fit. So I'll turn this over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we tried mightily to get that amendment in here to have the state IDs expire on the 21st birthday, and then 90 days after that they have to get it renewed, just like you did with the driver's licenses last year. But the drafter says unequivocally that we cannot do that because it wouldn't fit under the single subject rule, and would basically refused to do so because he said that somebody could sue us and say that it was an unconstitutional bill because we didn't accede to the single subject rule. So I
who's the drafter?
Jerry Luckup.
Jerry Luckup did.
And I asked him to go ahead and draft a second bill to do that. I really, really wanted to put that into this bill.
Yep, I understand. Yeah, it remains an interest of mine. Okay, so if we can, I'll get up with Jane on that here in just a moment. So let's talk about the at more length the provision for three misdemeanor counts, and in what time frame. I know that we are going to. That we're going to offer an amendment. Representative Dahlstrom is going to offer an amendment for you on page 3, line 22, to orders the defendant to refrain from consuming beverage for a period of time up to the lifetime.
Right, to be up to the lifetime of the defendant.
Okay. For a period of time, including during the term of any sentence as a condition of probation, is how that would read. And that's going to be, that is language that is coming from us, but it's acceptable to Char has weighed in on this, and they prefer that language. So let's talk about what happens after somebody gets their third misdemeanor charge for it's for domestic violence. Is that right, Representative Crawford?
Not just it's three misdemeanors committed under the influence of alcohol.
Okay,
and you know that could be public urination.
Right. Exactly. Exactly right.
And, you know, that what we're trying to do here, at the suggestion of Anchorage Police Department a couple of years ago, is to try to get this 100 to 200 frequent flyers that cost the municipality about 35% of their total.
Right. We have the same problem in Fairbanks.
Enforcement budget,
right.
to ride herd over these people that are continually right. in and out of the system, and alcohol is the problem.
Right. We have million-dollar We have million-dollar people in my community also that are in and out of the ER, that are the law enforcement knows on a first name basis, and that's why I'm particularly interested in this is whether this will help stem that, because the problem that we've run into as a community of Fairbanks, when I've monitored the discussion for the city council, is that you don't want to do enforcement in such a way that targets that gets dangerously close to targeting a demographic of people maybe. We talked about downtown zones. We talked about things that get dangerously close to singling out a group of people, not but by their behavior, but by some other demographic, which is not acceptable to any of us here, if I'm stating that tactfully enough.
Well, the only demographic that this would target is people that can't handle alcohol, and it takes the alcohol out of the equation, and many of these people are good people otherwise, but under the influence of alcohol, they're a danger to the public and to themselves. So this is still not a mandatory bill. I mean, it's still not a mandatory check, but under this bill, you could still require a driver's license, if they don't have a driver's license, a state ID, for them to purchase alcohol. And many of these chronic inebriates have neither. But if they have neither, then they can be refused the sale of alcohol. And, you know, some people, it might stop them from drinking. Some people may just go somewhere else. But at any rate, they won't be the problem in Anchorage or Fairbanks or Homer or Kenai that they are today. And I don't know how many people this will actually stop them from drinking. If it stops 10% or 20% or 30%, we've done a good thing. I wish I could say that this would stop 100% of the people that are abusing alcohol and abusing society because of that. It's not going to, but it is a step in the right direction. It's doing something to prevent the tragedies from happening that we hear about on a regular basis. So I can't tell you how important I feel this is. I hope we move it along.
All right. Are there any questions from members of the committee? Okay. Whitney, can you hear us?
Yes, Madam Chairman, I'm here.
Great. Could you identify yourself and your affiliation, and if we could have your comments on the bill, that would be great.
Yeah, for the record, my name is Whitney Brewster, Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. I'd like to start off by saying how much I appreciate Representative Crawford's commitment to trying to find a solution to the scourge that alcohol places upon Alaska. And currently the DMV puts a restriction called a J restriction on a driver's license and ID card for individuals who are restricted from purchasing alcohol as a condition of sentencing. And it reads, as Representative Crawford indicated, alcohol restricted in a red banner across the top of the ID card and the driver's license. We are supportive of the bill that Representative Crawford has put forth, and if I can answer any questions regarding the issue of adding ID cards as expiring on the 21st birthday or 90 days thereafter, I'm happy to try to answer those questions or any other questions that the committee might have.
Thank you. Whitney, it's Jay Ramirez. Thank you very much for your service. It's nice to hear your voice. We haven't seen you here yet this year, and it's nice to hear from you. I do have a question specifically on that. I had such high hopes for HB 75, which was an effort we did through this committee to require the mandatory expiration of minors' driver's licenses with on their 21st birthday with 90 days, and then an 8-question substance abuse test, which is so consistent with the intent of this bill. And Representative Crawford and I are on the same page. However, I know as a beverage dispensary licensee myself that it's not enjoying any enforcement. And I know that because when I have people over the age of 21 come into my property that are using a driver's license that has expired for 6 months or a year, they are they're still using it, and they're offended because this hasn't happened to any other beverage dispensary licensee where they've gone with a they're 22, 23 years old. And so I'm frustrated with this enforcement, and I thought we had kind of worked this out, and so it's a surprise to me that this calls into question, you know, through the single subject law, whether or not we can incorporate that into this piece of legislation. Can you tell me how we've done with the enforcement of HB 75? Because we thought Representative Crawford and I both thought that this bill was a vehicle to put red stripes on minors' driver's licenses in the same way that we're putting a red dot on three-time misdemeanor folks or alcohol felony folks. Can you talk about that for a moment, please?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. The Division of Motor Vehicles does indeed expire a license 90 days following the person's 21st birthday for driver's licenses. They are required then to come in, take an alcohol awareness test, and if they pass and they have the required documents, they are issued a horizontal license. Now, unfortunately, HB 75, although I think it has been very effective, it did not include identification cards. And I've had several conversations with Representative Crawford regarding this issue, that it would be, from the DMV's perspective, ideal to include identification cards in those same requirements as HB 75 presented. From there, when the liquor industry looks at these cards, you know, the enforcement parts out in the field, if you will, I don't know how well they're doing out there, but that's what's occurring here. We are expiring licenses. We are requiring the test, and we'd like to do the same thing with identification cards.
So would we. Are there other questions for Whitney? I'll take a brief of these for a second. We also have available for questions Quinlan Steiner, as they say, and Rachel Levitt. Quinlan's with Public Defender's Agency. Rachel Levitt is with OPA. Any questions? Are there questions there's questions on this bill? So Harry, if there's an extra $1,000 that is paid to the person that that collects this ID,
yes,
then how does that mechanism work? Is it a judgment that goes against the holder of the ID card? And then they owe the state, and the state pays. I mean, we're kind of turning into getting some entrepreneurship.
It's a civil fine, and I would imagine that your business has collected a few of them in the past. And the way Brown Jug does it, they settle it all up at one time during the year, because the way they work it right now is they share part of that $1,000 with their clerk that actually confiscated the license, and I think they said, oh, here's an example. Sorry,
it's all right. We're happy to see it.
Let's see. This is the vertical license. It says minor alcohol.
restricted, and it's under 21 until this date.
Okay.
So there's that red mark there, and this is what they look like with a...
Okay.
Sorry about that.
It's all right. We're keeping it together.
We have Chantel.
So I'm...
I'm just a sample.
I love
it. So Whitney, I have a question for you. Can we make a change by a regulation on the instructions on the red stripe here? The red stripe says under 21 until, and then features a date. So you clearly, we all understand what the intent of House Bill 75 was. We understand what the intent of House Bill 283 is. And the bills don't work until, you know, the practical application is, you were successful with the practical application. What authority do you have to alter the message in the red stripe on these driver's licenses for minors?
For the record, Mr. Chairman, this is Whitney Brewster, Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. I would really need to look into that. We do have wide latitude for adoption of regulations, and I think that we might be able to do that, but I would like to confirm that we have the ability to modify that language within the red banner.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate some latitude, Representative Crawford, and your bill is in good shape here, but you and I share a passion for some and most of the same issues that are addressed throughout your legislation on this issue. You know, and Whitney, when we passed House Bill 75, the intent of that was to make minors go take a test on substance abuse before they got behind the wheel of a car. And I can tell you from firsthand experience, where I have been in the property and seen an irate family or group of seven or nine people get up because our establishment refuses service to the 21 or 22 or 23-year-old who is still carrying around a minor's driver's license. And as they're leaving our establishment, they say very loudly that this has never happened to them in another establishment that they've gone into. And so you know, it doesn't help when I tell them I'm the one that passed the law. It doesn't really seem to create much goodwill for me in the establishment as they're leaving. It's kind of a double negative, if you know what I mean. And so looking at these minors' driver's licenses, I wonder if there is a sufficient latitude for DMV you know, I'm looking at like the photo of I'm a just a sample. And, you know, there's room down here for a red stripe on the bottom of her photo that says, you know, no alcohol purchases allowed with this ID, which would then add teeth. And I guess if we need to do a piece of legislation that Representative Crawford and I can talk about doing that after this meeting, or the Judiciary Committee could take one on. But I certainly know what the intent of it was. And Representative Crawford, you have the same intent with state IDs. Is that accurate?
That's right.
So if you want to get with our offices afterward and provide us some direction, Whitney, Representative Crawford and I work well together on some issues. And bring him around on oil taxes next, IDs first, oil taxes next. So if you want to look into that for us and then contact both of our offices, it's a shared interest that we have, and I think there's some consensus around this table. So, Representative Crawford, then if you can, we do have a couple people that want to testify from the public, Bonnie Hayes and Jerry McCutcheon. And if you can explain to me then, if I have a red dot ID and Representative Dahlstrom is a server or a clerk at a package store, and I go in and I present my ID and this bill passes and there's a $2,000 civil fine leveled against me, how and when does she get paid? Because she's going to see this as, you know, an incentive pay. Can you walk me through how that's going to work, which is different than the brown jug collecting $1,000 and then having a deal worked out with their clerks, which then becomes between, understood, between the Brown Jug and their employees. So can you take us through how that part of this entrepreneurial incentive works?
On that point, may I add something?
Mm-hmm. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, when the clerk receives their compensation, their bonus, is that added to their salary and they're taxed on it, so it potentially changes their tax bracket?
What I understand, Madam Vice Chair, is that it does, they do actually get taxed on this. This is treated the same way as wages, if I understand it correctly. And it's a civil fine, and sometimes it's difficult to collect those civil fines. So that's the reason why Brown Jug only settles up one time a year, and that they settle up on all the ones that they have actually gotten through the process in the past year. I think they do that at the end of March, I believe is what they told me. We haven't actually stipulated how the process would work between the employer and the employee. We've left that up to the employer to decide how they would work that.
So is this just doubles the fine is all?
It doubles the fine, and then the letter of intent says it's the intent of the legislature for that second $1,000 to be shared with the clerk that actually.
How?
You could give them a check or cash, I imagine.
No, I'm an employer, so now you've just crossed into a whole different area for me. I didn't.
And that's the way Brown Jug does it is they pay taxes on it just like wages.
Yeah, I'm not interested in how Brown Jug does it.
Be interested in doing it.
Well, I want to know how the state's going to be interested in doing it because this you just crossed over and made me feel very uncomfortable as an employer, because it's a whole. And I'm looking for a letter of support or something from some state agency which state agency would be responsible for the payment. I mean, how am I? I mean, I'm not. Do we have anybody from Brown Jug?
My
devil's in the details. Good afternoon,
Representative Ramrest and the committee.
Introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Paul Grassi. I'm staff for Representative Crawford, and as I understand this and how it was explained to me, is this is a civil award. Who pays it is the person who violates it.
By the ABC board.
And it's in other words, the basically what happens is you would collect the driver's license or the ID, the red ID or driver's license, and that would go. You would take that into small claims court. And there would be an award.
Who would?
ABC. ABC.
ABC
board.
Does.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that would then they would the court would issue a judgment.
Okay. Where's the letter? Where's the letter of intent?
You got it.
Okay. I have it here. Okay. Yeah, this. I'm sorry. This is going to have to be reworked here because you have just created a huge problem for me as an employer that I'm unhappy to. I'm not satisfied as the employer to take on this burden in this fashion, because this isn't supposed to put an additional burden on me as the employer. And so, just hear me out here. So I'm so happy with the intent of this piece of legislation, and we will pass this out. But you need to help me as an employer without burdening me with additional regulatory problems, which is something that I'm very much against. I need to know, because here, let me just take you through this. I got a red dot. on my driver's license, and my server captures the license, and she's now going to go to Bob Lynn, the proprietor of the restaurant or the package store, and say, where's my $1,000? And I do not want this server to be able to go file a claim with a wage and hour, say, where's my $1,000? Or you get the $1,000 from the employer, and then we violate other claims because appropriate taxes weren't taken out of him. And I don't understand how this letter of intent is too vague for me and needs to be reworked to incorporate the means of payment so that this is does not present a burden to the employer. And right now, I feel the burden of you just shifted it from a deal that Brown Jug has worked out internally between them and their clerks, and you've now shifted the burden onto an employer with a letter of intent. And as an employer, I am not willing to pass this through until I better understand the means of payment. How does the state collect it? Do you have to wait 2 years until the state is able to, if the person has bad credit, you have to collect it off of their permanent fund, and by then, you know, Representative Dahlstrom is living in Arizona. Do I have an obligation to find her and make payment to her? You're shaking your head no, but I don't have anybody from the state who's telling me how I'm going to get the $1,000. And I don't have any treatment of how the employer is supposed to move the $1,000 to that employee. And yet, I certainly have an employee who has the expectation of pay me. And I just did exactly what this law says, and now you've created another problem for me, because now if I don't pay him, I don't know how I get the $1,000. So I think we need to, if you're going to use Brown Jug as the example, then we need to know what their means are right now and what their means would be with this letter of intent incorporated, and how they collect the money through the ABC. How long does it take? When do they pay their employees? What happens if their employees are no longer have an employment relationship with them once the means of payment has been made? I need some additional answers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And could I?
Yes, sir.
And you've brought up a number of issues here, and if I can remember each one of them,
okay,
I'll try to give you those answers. This is a letter of intent, so the employee has no expectation of actually receiving any of this money. They have no legal expectation of receiving it. When they're no longer in your employ, you don't have to share it with them. You don't have to share it with them under this letter of intent.
And you're just doubling the fine? Is that really?
We are just doubling the fine. That is and we would wish that you share it with your employee, but we're not requiring that. This was only hoping that you, as an employer, would see your way clear to share some of that, because they were the ones that actually did catch the fake license. I mean, or not fake license, but red stripe license. I don't know how you do this presently when you get underage driver's licenses and get the $1,000 fine that you presently get, but it would be in the exact same fashion as what you do when you get a fake underage driver's license and you get your $1,000 now. And I, you know, how you deal with that is up to you.
Yeah, I have the ABC board then is going to need to weigh in on this and tell me how this money is collected. This isn't what you told me this bill does.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
This is exactly what the way it was written up, and I tried to answer your questions several times, and I have been by here numerous times to ask you if you had any questions about what might be coming up.
Then I'll take responsibility for the fact that I'm not prepared then at this time to move this piece of legislation. I would like to hear from the ABC board and how the $1,000 is collected. And my understanding was that this bill got $1,000 to employees, that it increased the amount of fine and incentivized the employees that are on the front lines to get more, to have an incentive, and it doesn't address the distribution to them. And this letter of intent is incomplete, and you refer to the Brown Jug, so we could hear from them hear what their system is, and we should hear from the ABC board as to how they're collecting these civil fines and at what point. Because if it's an ongoing operation, then I see the incentive. I don't believe that we've ever put in for this, and you know, we're just it's not the way we run our business. I didn't know that I'd get $1,000, but we don't recork wine, and that was my idea years ago. Mm-hmm. We've never done it because my staff says the regulations aren't in place, even though restaurants throughout the state do it. So we've got my own little bureaucracy going at my place. But
Mr. Chairman,
yes, sir.
We are not allowed to award this to the employee. Under the law, the civil fine can only go to the person or the entity
establishment. So we're just doubling the fine.
We're doubling the fine. That's Why? The only legal thing Why? That we're doing here.
Why?
To have more of an incentive for people to actually check this driver's for this driver's license, because people aren't doing it. You know, that there are a number of businesses that you can walk in when you look like me in my age, and they'll hand you whatever kind of alcohol you want, and they won't ask you for a driver's license or anything. And that's the reason why I wanted to give that business more of an incentive to check the driver's license or state ID.
Okay, well, we're not going to move this bill today. We have testimony from Bonnie Hayes and Jerry McCutcheon. We can try and take that testimony, and then we will make an appointment to get together, and I will better understand what my concerns are, and I will share those with you. Can we hear from Bonnie Hayes first, please?
This is Bonnie. Can you hear me?
Yes, Go ahead, Bonnie.
I'm Bonnie Hayes. I'm 45 years old, and I'm a convicted drunk driver. I have 2 DUIs, and I have a red stripe on my license. Before I just want to tell you, first of all, that I do not think that this $1,000 is going to even be an issue. Because if I get carded, do you think that I'm going to show them my red license? No, I walk out of the store. So that's just a small issue. But the thing is that the clerk has an incentive to ask me. And that's the intent, and that's good enough. But the reason I'm here is because I just wanted to tell you, I had 2 DUIs, and I got my license back before this law was in place. But I saw this as a wonderful tool that I could use to help me stay sober. And I went down to the DMV because I have been court ordered not to buy alcohol. I had this strike put on my license. I went back to the liquor stores I used to buy alcohol from, and they knew me, and I showed them the card, and they won't sell me alcohol now. And for the most part, I am sober. I'm in treatment, I'm in AA, and I have gotten my life back together. But I will tell you something that I have learned through these past 5 years, is that only 4% of alcoholics ever get sober and stay sober. The rest of us spend the rest of our lives in and out of relapse. We can go years and years, and then one day, for no reason, just out of the blue, get a little voice that says, okay, I can have just one. We've already gone past that point. We can't handle alcohol. And that's the baffling nature of this disease. Don't understand it. And I'm not asking you to understand it, because I don't understand it. Ask any judge, doctor, counselor, therapist. We don't understand why this happens. But once an alcoholic has crossed over into this this chronic stage of the disease, there's no explanation. A person could have 15, 20 years sobriety, and then out of the blue they decide, I'm going to have a beer with that pizza at that restaurant. And the next thing they know, they are back into practicing alcoholism, because that's the way it works. And so the point is, if you can stop me from buying alcohol, you're going to stop me from drinking and driving. Because I'll tell you right now, if I decide that I'm going to drink, there's a really good chance I'm going to drink and drive. And Harry's right, punishment doesn't work, because on my next DUI, I face a felony charge, which means I go to jail. I lose my job. I have got a great job. I lose my family. I lose everything. And that is not, as I'm driving down the road and I see that liquor store and I'm thinking to myself, I'm going to have just one, you know, that's not necessarily, I don't even think about that. That doesn't even cross my mind because I think I'm just going to have one and that's it. But that doesn't happen because I'm an alcoholic. And after I have that one, there's like some switch that just gets flipped. And that's kind of the way it works. And another thing about this is that this stripe on the license is put on right away. It's put on immediately after the DUI. And this is a critical time for those people like me that...
Bonnie?
Yes.
Bonnie, I appreciate it. We're beginning to bump up against our time. So my question for you is do you think that there is any additional incentive for you if you have a red stripe on your license that there's a $2,000 fine against you rather than a $1,000 fine against you?
Oh, absolutely! It's huge. I like I said, if I was trying to buy alcohol and somebody carded me, and I knew that fine was coming.
Do you think you would? Do you think you knew before you testified to the legislature? Do you think that you knew that there was a $1,000 fine and or that it had been doubled?
Did I know that?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes. No, I didn't. I thought the red stripe was just something so that they would just not serve me. I didn't realize that there was a fine. Now that I do know that, it gives me even a bigger incentive because it's not just a fine. It's another misdemeanor. It's not just a fine because I am not allowed to buy alcohol. It's court ordered.
We're very grateful for your testimony, but what I'm trying to isolate here is when you said that you attend AA meetings, and I applaud you for your sobriety, and I hope you collect your 10-year and your 20-year and your 30-year pin. I have many friends of mine that go to Celebrate Recovery. My Uncle Bill is 25 years sober, and I love him with all my heart, and he's begun the Celebrate Recovery at Zion Lutheran Church in Fairbanks, and I attend there sometimes with him, and the testimony is compelling. So my question, though, is that this bill, one of the provisions that this bill addresses is doubling the fine from $1,000 to $2,000. Do you think that the people that you attend some of the AA meetings with who have a red hash mark on their driver's license, do you think that doubling the fine serves to motivate them any more or less to not present their ID for
absolutely. Okay. It is a huge motivator.
Why?
And again, because it's everything that goes along with it. It's not just the fine itself.
No,
that's
all we're talking about right now.
That's an incentive. I mean, $2,000 is a lot of money.
Okay. All right. Bonnie, I thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions for Bonnie? I don't see any at the table. We thank you very much for calling in today, and again, I applaud you on the forward steps that you're making and for your the testimony in the building. I heard about your passionate testimony in the Labor and Commerce Committee. Can we go to Jerry McCutcheon, please?
Yes.
Jerry?
For the record, my name is Jerry McCutcheon. Okay. The bill should be expanded to contain anyone with a court order and prohibition. Second, it is basically a toothless tiger. It needs to be some teeth put into the legislation, so carding is mandatory. The opportunistic drunk that killed the Cuddy child, that killed the Penn Air child, that killed my friend and a state employee did not start out to get drunk. They were simply driving by a liquor store and they bought a bottle. I've been at this since 1982, when Mad Mothers first started. Those people, those children would be alive. Lots of them. But it's always been a toothless tiger. The first bill was written by Senator Ferguson, 1982. I thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Mr. McCutcheon? All right. Seeing none, we are going to hold this bill over. We have ample time to bring it up in a timely fashion. Representative Crawford, you have convinced me not to attach the the red hash marks that we had discussed that we both thought could be put into this because of the single subject rule. And I also am very pleased about the solutions that are presented for three-time misdemeanor offenders who can then get a red hash, because I think that they are they're a blight on society and on our police departments. And as you say, they require a lot of other they require a small population requires an enormous amount of resources. I am not convinced that this $2,000 is anything but doubling the amount of money that goes to the brown jug. The statute book that we looked at while we were taking testimony says that it's not the ABC board that goes to file a civil claim. It's actually the licensee. So somebody that would be precisely why I haven't done this before. I don't have an attorney on staff. I can't afford to go make small claims against individuals. I'm not set up to do that. So we just refuse service, and so we will not take the committee's time at 5 minutes past three to work on this. But we will work on this with you. But this letter of intent puts too many burdens on the employer to make me comfortable as an employer. We will look to work with you on this. And then I need to be persuaded why a $2,000 fine is that much more greatly incentivizes somebody who's already, an alcohol felon, or has three misdemeanors against them. So we will set aside some time to work together on this. Are there any final comments from members of the committee? Representative Gatto?
Just a thought for the people that have testified. I just wonder if, just take an extreme, if we deleted the fine altogether, so there was no fine, would that change your behavior?
So the 1,000, 2,000, we see this a lot with domestic violence when you make the fine greater. At the moment that a person is about to strike another person, they are not contemplating the penalty. And that's one of the problems that we have in here as we take up domestic violence issues. So with that, at 5 minutes after three, we're adjourned.
I'm ready.